of value is not necessarily that you are living that value. It's that you would, that's something that you hold to be very, very important.
I'd like to welcome David Allison to the Productivityist podcast. David, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me over. Actually, I'm not over. I'm just like, we're connecting, but we're not like, we're socially distanced like we're supposed to be.
Yeah. It's actually very rare when I have anybody in the studio anyways. They're normally here from Victoria, but I can't even have that right now. So anyway, I want to get into, first off, before we dive into like who you are and why you're on the show, one of the things we've had a couple of chances to converse, thanks to our mutual friend, Katie Jordan. I want to talk about values and when Katie said, you've got to go look at what David's offering. And I saw, you know, go to value graphics, and we're going to put all the links in the show notes here, of course. It immediately resonated with me. There's a qualitative element to values, and then graphics is very, to me, very quantitative. And I want to kind of dive into that because I talk about qualitative and quantitative productivity. And when I saw this, I'm like, okay, what can David bring to the table? So first, can you tell me a little bit about what you do, how you got into this, and what, this is a big question, what is value graphics?
Wow, that's three questions all at once. Let's see if I can do this.
You can.
my name is David Allison. I am a human behavior expert. I'm the pioneer of what we call values thinking, and I'm the founder of the Value Graphics database. And what we've done is, to go to your point, we've found a way with masses and masses and masses of research, thanks to AI and what we can do now with technology and survey technologies, we've found a way to build the very first database ever of what everybody on the planet cares about, what we value. So this is a qual-quant database. It's a very, very quantitatively accurate thing. It's plus or minus 3.5% accurate with a 95% level of confidence. So the statisticians, anybody who's listening who's a statistician is going to light their hair on fire and run out of the room when I tell them it's a random stratified statistically representative sample of the population of the entire planet. So it is definitely a quantitative tool. But we've used qualitative analysis in order to get there. So it's referred to as qual-quant data. And we've managed to find a way to take all of these philosophical conversations that the world has been having about values and our corporate values and our brand values and our personal values. It's all been very philosophical and well-meaning. But now we can have data around values, and we can actually use them as a tool to help us understand why people do the things they do and how we might be able to influence those outcomes.
And one of the things that I think is really important, especially in times of uncertainty, is to not just have this idea of, okay, here's what the numbers look like, but what the value, like what you're measuring, right? So you wrote a blog post, which I'm going to link to, from March 31st about leadership in the time of extreme uncertainty. And what I loved about this is that you actually are able to break what everyone's focused on down. So there is that qualitative. Can we talk a little bit about how valuable, no pun intended, this kind of data can be in times of uncertainty?
Yeah, I'm going to paint a little bit of a picture here because it's sort of a problem solution scenario that we need to go through. So the problem is the way we try and understand each other right now, the way we try and understand everything in the world is by using demographics and psychographics. So we say to ourselves, okay, we're going to try and get this group of people to do something. We want them to buy a product. We want them to believe something. We want them to act in a certain way. Well, who are they anyway? And we sit down and we come up with a little bit of a description. And we say to ourselves, maybe they're 18 to 24 and they're men and they make $50,000 a year and they graduated with a Bachelor of Arts and they're single, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we get into psychographics around them and we say to ourselves, well, gee, they've behaved this way in the past around this particular thing that we're interested in getting them to do something different around. And then we start making assumptions and we say to ourselves, well, based on that, geez, they're young guys and they've got a little bit of money and they got a cause. They must like blue because boys like blue, right? Or they're millennials, and so they must like avocado toast. I mean, we've got to bring that joke up. Or they're baby boomers, and therefore they hate the environment, and they drive giant SUVs. We have these giant stereotypical ideas in our head of what people are like based on what they are, not who they are.
Right.
So this is a problem. Mm-hmm. This is a problem because we're spending millions and millions and millions of dollars trying to talk to people, trying to influence people, trying to engage with people based on faulty, flawed data.
Just to interject real quick, it's the biases, right? It's those biases that we have that are ingrained that tend to lead us down that path, right?
Absolutely. We've never really had another choice. There's been social shaming penalties in the past for not behaving a certain way at a certain age. Let's go back far enough in time and say to ourselves, if you were a young woman in a village in rural France in the 1400s, and you hadn't started producing babies and adding to the population of your village yet, you weren't living up to your part of the bargain, and there was social shaming to deal with. And if you were a young man at a certain point in history and you hadn't gone out and started like slaying the enemy and bringing home the mastodon for dinner, you weren't doing the things you were supposed to do. So demographics and demographic behaviors have been around for a very, very long time. But you know what's happened is we have technology now. We have the ability to understand how everything in the world works. We have so much knowledge. We are so similar to each other now that we don't need to follow those rules anymore. We can all curate our lives pretty much however we like. We can do whatever we want, more or less, at any stage and regardless of who we are, everywhere on Earth. And yet we still use these demographic stereotypes to try and understand each other and spend trillions of dollars a year trying to target and influence these groups of people based on faulty, flawed information about who they are. So what's the answer? The answer is that we have to understand why people do the things they do. And if we understand why people behave the way they do, and we start to talk to them based on those clusters of pieces, those data points, then we're going to be a lot more successful at understanding what we can create and what we can make happen. And so the answer is in sociology. In the social sciences and sociology, it's been a long-held belief, and it's been studied and proven over and over and over again. One simple sentence: what we value determines what we do. And in fact, I was talking to a neuroscientist this morning who was explaining to me that our values sit at our prefrontal cortex, at the front of our brain. And every piece of information that comes into our brains to be processed passes through our values. So indeed, our values, even just from a biological perspective, influence every decision that we make. The problem has been we've never had enough data about large-scale groups of people and what they value in common for this to be able to be a useful tool. So now we do. We built this massive data set. We have 500,000 surveys from around the world. We've measured 436 different things that people value, what they care about, what they want and need and expect out of their lives. And now we can replace stereotypes about boomers and millennials and men and women and rich people and poor people. We can replace all those stereotypes that are inaccurate from olden days with accurate current information about what people care about. And now we can design a world full of products and services and ideas based on what we actually all care about and what we value. This is a massive shift. This is disrupting demographics and instead replacing it with value graphics.
What led you down this path? Because this is, to me, like, this is super fascinating, because it is that qualquant, that data that we want. But there must have been something that you said, you know, was there a tipping point, or was there a specific incident that said, you know, I need to do this? Because you've done a lot of work and put a lot of time, energy, and attention to this. What was the thing that said, you know what, I'm going to dig into this?
Well, it was a combination of factors, I think. And anybody, I think, if they sit and look at what they're doing, if they're passionate about their work, realizes that there's been a whole lot of events over the course of their life that they didn't really know why these things were happening. And then suddenly they all kind of smack together and you go, this is what I'm supposed to be all about. So I'd spent most of my life in marketing. I'd spent most of my life working for clients and helping them understand how to spend all their money to try and talk to a group of people and get them to do something, buy something, rent a service, buy a condo, whatever it was that we were hired to do. And we were using demographic and psychographic profiles of these audiences. And my last company that I sold 4 or 5 years ago, before I started getting into this research, it was all about selling very, very expensive condominiums. So real estate developers would hire us when they're going to build a new tower. And we would name the tower, and then we'd come up with the ad campaign for the tower. And over the course of a few months, we'd spend a couple of million bucks attracting people to come and buy expensive condominiums and towers. And then about 2 years later, we'd go to the opening and there'd be the ribbon cutting and the mayor was there and everybody was all excited. And we'd look around the room and realize that nobody in that room matched the demographic profile that we thought we were selling these condos to. So we had just wasted millions of dollars talking to a bunch of people who never showed up, but somehow all these other people showed up. And so that was one point for me, was just like, wait a minute, what's going on here? How come these folks are here? We didn't talk to them. This wasn't for supposed to be for them. And where are all the people that we thought we were doing this for? How come they're not here? So that was in the back of my head. Next thing that happened that kind of pushed me down this road was, oh my gosh, I don't even know what to call it, the imaginary millennial movement, where we all sat around saying to ourselves, millennials this, millennials that, millennials are ruining everything, millennials are only like this, millennials like that. I was reading an article in the New York Times Magazine one weekend, and it was all about what millennials' hobbies are, because clearly they all have the same hobbies. They're one big giant hive mind. And I just had had it. I just like, this is ridiculous. This can't be possible. This can't possibly be true. So I set out in this real estate sector that I had been working in to do some research and write another book specifically about how could we build towers and condominiums and cities and places to live that weren't based on age. And the data started coming back. We did 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 surveys initially across North America to see what would it take for people to live together, regardless of how old they were. And what would the thought patterns be around that? And the data was very clear on two points. The first thing is nobody wants to live in a building full of people the same age as they are. The word ghetto came up a lot.
Wow.
Serious, hardcore. Like, I don't want to be in a building full of just young people or just old people. And then the second thing is, and remember, we're talking about housing here. We're talking about the most expensive monthly expenditure that anybody ever has. The data came back that people would pay as much as 15% more than market for a rental or a condo, as long as they knew one thing. And that was that they were living in a building full of people who shared their values. Now, they said it in different ways, but they were basically all saying, I want to be around people who are just like me. I don't care how old they are. In fact, I don't want to be around people who are just the same age as me. I want to be around people who are like me, who look at the world the same way I do, who think the same things are important that I think, and I'll pay more to be with that group of people. So that made me think, wow, if that's the case for the most expensive thing we ever are going to buy, why wouldn't that also be the same for sunglasses and vacations and flower vases and teacups and pens and pencils and everything else in our world? Why wouldn't values be more important than demographics as a way to understand what people are interested in and how we can motivate them? So that's when the big research started. We got to 75,000 surveys initially to prove that values were a much better way to understand how people make decisions and be able to take that data and segment it around a particular product or service or brand. And that covered Canada and the United States. So my first book came out, it was about that.
Right.
Now, as of last October, we are global. So we now are accurate for 180 countries around the world. We've used 152 different languages to collect all of this information and crunch it all together and build what we believe to be the world's very first database of what everybody on the planet cares about. And I think it's the pivot point that's going to take us to a whole new way of thinking about each other and change the way we look at each other and, in fact, change the way we look at the world.
So one of the things that you mentioned right on your book page, which I'm going to link to in the show notes about the book, We Are All the Same Age Now, which is a nice dovetail from what we just talked about. The first thing you said was values drive action. There's a lot of people that are just writing down their to-do list and trying to just, quote, as I say, do productive. They're just checking off as many boxes as possible. They're being rather reckless or even ruthless with their productivity, not really reasoned. Can you talk about the that idea of how someone can say, okay, you know what? I don't have time to really get my values in check so I can drive my to-do list and drive my action the way it's supposed to be given. Because you're not even saying values drive right action. You're saying values drive action. So how would you work with someone or convince someone that, hey, look, get these values sorted first, then your actions are going to be the right action? I'd love to hear that, because a lot of people just, they don't take that moment, that step, that time to do that.
Well, you know what? I think they do. I just don't think they realize they're doing it.
Right. Okay.
I'm going to tell you a quick little story.
Sure.
It really helps make this snap into a place for a lot of people when I talk about this. It's called Three Friends in an Alley at Midnight. So the story goes like this. Three friends are out having a few drinks, and they've had a few too many drinks a few too many hours ago, so they're a little bit happier than they would normally be. And it's midnight, and they're walking down the street, and they're being raucous, and they're punching each other in the shoulder and having a great time. And they turn a corner, and suddenly there's a dark alley, and they have to make a decision. And all we know about friend number one is that the primary value for friend number one is adventure. So of course, friend number one thinks it's an amazing idea to go down this alley. I love you guys. We've had a few drinks. Let's go down the alley. What a great way to end the night. And friend number two, the only thing we know is their primary value is safety. I love you guys. Why would we go down this alley? Let's go back to the bar and turn on the lights. We might even have to call the police. Who knows? What a silly idea to go down that alley. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And friend number three, the only thing we know is their primary value is friendship. Don't really care whether we go down the alley. Don't care if we go back to the bar. As long as we stick together, guys, I love you. Let's just make sure we stick together. That's what matters. So here's three people, and they're faced with the same set of stimuli, and they're making their decisions based on what they value. Now, they may not know that they're doing that. And it's interesting, if you think about this story for a moment, that none of them, we don't care how old they are, if they're male or female or rich or poor, or have an MBA or a BA, or if they're a journalist or a scientist, if they have 2.3 kids, what kind of car they drive, none of that matters. The only way they make a decision when they're faced with a situation is based on what they value. So that's how important values are to everything that you do all day long. Whether you know it or not, you are making every decision in your life 24/7, 365, based on your values. You're going to stand in the grocery store and say, which can of soup am I going to buy? I've got three of them in my hands here. Somehow, what you value is directing the decision that you're going to make. So if we take this back to an individual level and say, how can people use this to be more productive? Spending some time trying to figure out what's the most important thing to you in the world. Nothing to do with your job, or it might be. Nothing to do with your family, unless it is. But what are the most important values in your life? And then using that and realizing that that's how you are viewing the things that you have to decide to do during the course of the day. Psychologists and psychiatrists have been doing this for centuries. They give you an MMPI inventory. They give you a Myers-Briggs test. They understand what your individual values are. And then they work with you to get your values in alignment with your reality. And you know what that creates? A happy person, a well-adjusted person. When we talk about someone being well-adjusted, what we mean is their values are in alignment with their life. So whether you know you're doing it or not, when you're sitting down and making a to-do list, or you're deciding how you're going to time block, or you're deciding what kind of days, what you're going to do on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, your decisions are happening because of what you value. It's really that simple.
We're going to take a break from the program for a moment, but when we come back, I'm going to talk to David about the idea of the difference between virtues and values, and whether or not he finds them similar, and also how validating it feels when he sees something that is proof of his concept. But first, I want to talk to you about email. I mean, we're all so inundated with email now that it's no longer about responding to everything. It's really about responding only to the important things, you know, the messages that truly matter. And that's where Sanebox comes in. Think of Sanebox as a robotic Marie Kondo for your email. You know, as messages flow in, Sanebox does the triage for you, leaving only the important emails in your inbox and directing all the other distracting stuff to your Sane Later folder. So you know the messages that you need to pay attention to now, and you also can have an idea of what stuff you need to get to later on. Now, Sanebox also has some other really cool features like Sane Black Hole, where you can drag messages from annoying senders that you never want to hear from again, and Sane Reminders to ping you if someone hasn't replied to your email by a certain date. I use that all the time with people who are interested in either having me on their podcast or vice versa, and that way I can follow up with them. Best of all, you can use Sanebox with any email client or phone, really anywhere that you check your email. You can see how Sanebox can magically remove distractions from your inbox with a free 2-week trial. Just visit sanebox.com/timecrafting and you can start your free trial and get a $25 credit. So that's sanebox.com sanebcrafting.com/timecrafting to get that $25 credit and the free trial today. Again, that's sanebox.com/timecrafting to get that free trial and $25 credit. Do it today. So you're sitting at home learning from podcasts and audiobooks, but you want to do something more. You want to take your career, your education to the next level. Well, the UCI Division of Continuing Education can do that. The UCI Division of Continuing Education offers convenient, quality online education. There's really never a better time to take advantage of what the UCI Division of Continuing Education has to offer, and they're not new to online education. They have been providing students with quality online courses for years. You can learn on your own time online. Now, the UCI Division of Continuing Education can help you gain the edge in your career or help you launch a business entirely. They provide you with the flexibility to stay on top of your game in your current role while preparing for you to level up. Certificate programs are available as well as specialized studies programs. Certificate programs offer an in-depth body of knowledge to ensure that you gain mastery of a particular topic. Specialized studies feature shorter, more concentrated curricula for those short on time. Both are distinctive achievements that can help prepare you for career advancement or transition, and you can advance your career in as little as 6 months. Spring quarter is now open, so enroll today. Visit ce.uci.edu/productivityist and enter the promo code TIMECRAFTING for 15% off of one course. That's ce.uci.edu/productivityist and then enter the promo code TIMECRAFTING for 15% off of one course. Now, this discount is for almost all of the certificate programs. The exceptions only include coding boot camps, international programs, teacher credentialing programs, and test prep courses. And this offer is only valid until July 31st, 2020 at 11:59 p.m. So take advantage of what you can get out of the UCI Division of Continuing Education. Visit ce.uci.edu/productivityist and then enter the promo code TIMECRAFTING for that 15% discount off of one course today. The perfect hire can have an impact on your business for years to come. So when you need to find that next person to help grow your business, LinkedIn Jobs will match the right talent with your open role fast. Now, LinkedIn Jobs screens candidates with the hard and soft skills that you're looking for if you're hiring, so you can hire the right person fast. Things like collaboration, creativity, adaptability. LinkedIn looks beyond the work skills and puts your job post in front of qualified candidates who match your business requirements perfectly. And that's how LinkedIn makes sure your job post is seen by the people that you want to hire. People with the skills, qualifications, and other interests that will help your business grow. It's really no wonder that a person is hired every 8 seconds with LinkedIn. And that's why companies rated LinkedIn Jobs the number one hiring platform for delivering quality hires. Again, the platform is exploding. You want to be on there right now, and you want to find the right person for your business today with LinkedIn Jobs. You can pay what you want and get the first $50 off. Just visit linkedin.com/timecrafting. Again, that's linkedin.com/timecrafting to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. So again, linkedin.com/timecrafting and get the first $50 off of your first job posting today. Now let's get back to my conversation with David Allison here on the Productivityist podcast. I want to shift gears a little bit for a second, and I want to discuss, because I think that what a lot of people do when they're looking at, they look at words. So the word values, and I mean, this is something that when I look at what you do, it can be layered on top of a company's or a person's existing system as a way to, again, like you've said, you know, improve decision making, you know, make planning more strategic, you know, and if you're dealing with customers, and you mentioned this on your page, you like optimize their journey. But do you think that there's a difference between the idea of values and the idea of virtues, or are they kind of the one side of the same coin?
That's the first time anybody's brought the word virtues. I think about virtues in a very sort of spiritual context as the kinds of values that our parents would like us to have, the virtuous values. In fact, there's all kinds of values, some of which our parents would very much like us not to have. And I think that my work and the work that we're trying to do with companies and with organizations of all sorts all over the world is about helping them identify which values, good or bad, are the ones that are rising to the top for the audiences that they're trying to influence. Let me make this concrete for everybody who's listening for a moment. We'll compare some values from different parts of the world and just have a little fun with this and see where we go. So if we look at the United States and Canada, for example, the number one value in the United States and Canada is health and well-being. Now, immediately, my spidey sense goes off and says, really? All I hear about is how out of shape and we don't eat well, we're not exercising enough, and all these things about what it is to be an American or what it is to be a Canadian. More so the Americans that have this compulsion around not matching up to that mythological Swede that is perfectly fit at the age of 79. But health and well-being as a value is not necessarily that you are living that value. It's that that's something that you hold to be very, very important. It's the number one value across that entire country. Now, if we take that and we go instead and we look at the Middle East, just randomly picking something else, the Middle East's number one value for the entire population is morality. Now, think about that for a moment. We've got a group of people, an entire country, an entire region of the world, where morality is the number one thing that they use to make decisions. Am I doing the right things in the right way for the right reasons to get to the right place? In the United States and Canada, instead, what we're doing is saying, how is what I'm about to do going to impact my health and well-being, my idea of myself as being a healthy and well-adjusted person? So one of these countries, one of these regions of the world has got a very sort of outward facing way of solving problems and looking at things, whereas another region of the world has got a very inward facing way of thinking about what's this decision that's in front of me and how am I going to decide whether I'm going to go down this dark alley or not. If we take it back to the dark alley story, you got one friend who's standing there trying to decide what to do about this dark alley, and their primary value is health and well-being. Well, they're probably going to look at this and say, yeah, I don't think I'm going to go down there. Who knows what's going to happen? It's probably not going to be good for me. And we've got another person from the Middle East who's looking at this dark alley and is going to say, well, what's the right decision here? What's the right thing to do? How do I get to the right place in the right way? I don't know how they're going to decide what to do about that dark alley, but that's the decision-making tool they're going to use as they face that decision.
I want to talk about something that, as I was going through your website, and this happens to me too, I find stories that I come across that validate the kind of work that I'm doing. And you had one that is fairly recent, not too long ago. The nice thing about doing this recording now is we're literally a few days from publishing this episode. But the reason it resonates with me too is that the date that you publish this post is my daughter's birthday. So February 13th, 2020, you posted a piece called Who We Are Is Very Important, What We Are Is Not. And you mentioned that, like, why did this, this made me weep with joy. And I'll link to it in the show notes, obviously, so people can watch it. How validating is it when you come across the survey data that you get alone is validating, but something like this that may not have been from, like, you necessarily surveying it, but it's just the proof of concept outside of it. Like, that's got to feel really good.
Oh, it's amazing. I guess the best story I can tell about that, I don't even remember what that particular post is that you're talking about.
Hey, you're gonna have to go. So now you have to read the show notes.
I'm going to have to read the show notes. I'm furiously looking up at on my blog as we're talking here, and I can't get to it fast enough.
It's the Danish TV station commercial.
Oh my goodness, what an amazing thing that was. Yes, I do hope we can find a link for that to everybody.
I'm going to put it in the show notes for sure. Absolutely.
So it's this simple, simple commercial where a group of people who don't resemble each other at all, they all get together in a room. They're all asked to come, then they're assembled together in a room. And slowly but surely, questions are asked. Questions like, who's divorced? And people who are divorced all stand up. And then who was bullied as a child? And they all stand up. And then I can't remember what the other questions are, but the point of the commercial is by the time they've asked 10 or 12 questions, it becomes so obvious that they're so similar. Everyone in that room who looks so different from each other, they're all different ages. They're both genders. There's gay people and straight people, and there's young people and guys who look like they'd beat me up in a back lane, and guys who look like they probably, you know, I don't know. They just, it couldn't be a more diverse group of people. And if you looked at that group of people demographically and tried to sort them out into groups, you would never have put them into the groups that that commercial over the course of that 60, 90 seconds. It shows you that there's so many similarities amongst us, so many reasons why we are so alike that have nothing to do with any of these false and crazy demographic ideas that were used to run the entire world right now. It's such faulty data. We'll come back to data. It's such faulty data. Let me give you a couple of stats just to back that up.
Sure.
We have 500,000 surveys now around the world, as I've mentioned, accurate for 180 different countries, 152 languages we've used to collect all this information. And if we just for fun, let's take baby boomers and say, how often do you think baby boomers agree with each other on anything in the 436 different metrics that we've measured, what people care about and what's important to them, what they want and what they expect out of their lives? Baby boomers only agree with each other 13% of the time. And so what that means in the real world is if you're trying to target baby boomers as an audience to get them to believe something or do something or change a behavior or buy a product, you have at best a 13% ROI on every dollar an hour that you spend trying to talk to them. And you're not, that's only if you do everything perfectly. And by the way, we're all human. We're not going to do everything perfectly. So you maybe get, if you're really, really good at your job, you might get a 10% ROI on that dollar or that hour that you spend trying to target baby boomers. Generation X only agrees with each other 11% of the time. And millennials, who we've spent the last two decades trying to sort out what it is that we ought to do to make those guys happy, because they're all the same, apparently. Millennials only agree with each other. They're only the same 15% of the time. Now, to make those numbers even more ridiculous and snap them into reality for us, we all agree with each other as human beings walking on this planet alive in the year 2021. Where are we? 2020.
We're still in 2020. It seems like it's going to last forever.
We all agree with each other 8% of the time just because we're human. So you get that. That's the table stakes. You get that for free. So now you start subtracting that from these similarity numbers around any of these demographic categories. And by the way, it's not just age. It's about men. It's about women. How often do they agree with each other? It's about people who earn, you know, $75,000 a year, people who earn $100,000 a year, people who have a college degree. We don't agree with anybody who's in a group of people with us based on some outward characteristic about our demographic profile. We do agree incredibly with people who have the same values that we do. So across those same 436 different metrics, for example, if we say, let's just look at people who list environmentalism as their number one most important value in their life, we can get a similarity ranking across those same 436 metrics as high as 70, 80, 90% of the time. So your dollar, your hour you spend trying to talk to those folks, you're going to get a 70, 80, 90% ROI instead of a 10, 11, 12% ROI. If it's my buck, I want the 70% ROI, the 70 cent dollar that I want to be out there trying to make change happen with. So what's really exciting, if I can just like totally change the direction of this makes tons of sense for corporations, of course. You know, organizations, this is how I make a buck. They come to me and they say, David, help me understand our audience. We want to know what they care about, not just what their demographics are. And I say, sure, and I charge them some money. But then what we get to do with that is we get to take that money and we use it to give the data away to humanitarian organizations that are making changes happen around the world.
Right.
We've basically got this tool now that can make large numbers of people rethink their behaviors and behave in a way that they otherwise wouldn't, because we can talk to them about what they care about. So you think about all the problems that we're faced with in the world right now. One of my favorite examples is single-use plastics. We all know this is a terrible, terrible situation that we're faced with. We're throwing single-use plastics into the landfills and into our oceans. In fact, we're dumping single-use plastics into the oceans at a rate of one dump truck per minute, 24/7, 365. Imagine that. A dump truck a minute. Jeez. All day, every day. Now, if we understood what people care about and we could talk, we could give data to all the organizations out there that are trying to get people to stop using single-use plastics, and we could say to them, here's the stuff you need to focus on in this part of the world. And in this part of the world, you need to be saying these things. And in this part of the world, you need to be triggering these values. If we could even make a dent of 5% in the amount of single-use plastics that we throw out there, that would be an amazing thing to know that we've helped to accomplish. So the really the driving force behind what we're trying to do here is it's a Robin Hood strategy. We're going to help corporations get the 70, 80% more effective in what they're doing with all the work they're trying to do to get their audiences to do the things they'd like them to do so that we can help all these not-for-profit organizations around the world who are trying to not just save the planet, but deal with refugee crisis and disease spreads and all the other stuff that we're faced with as a as this organism called the planet Earth and all the problems that we have that we can fix if we can change some behaviors. And I just will close that little thought bubble with this. I know we can do this because we've changed behaviors before. There's so many examples of this through the course of history. We all decided to start wearing seatbelts. The right values got triggered at some point. It got triggered enough that we all said, yeah, you know what? Seatbelts. We got to wear seatbelts. Mm-hmm. We all decided that quitting smoking was a really good thing, that smoking wasn't cool anymore. And so most of us have quit smoking. So we can change behaviors. The problem with those old ways of trying to do it is they take forever. Right. Because we didn't know exactly what to say and what triggers were going to work in what parts of the world with which populations of people. Well, now we do. Now we can do that scientifically with this Qualquant data.
David, this has been a great conversation. I've got, I'm going to put some links to some other episodes in the show notes because we've had Rich Carlgaard, who wrote Late Bloomers, and also Carl Honoré, fellow Canadian, who wrote Boulder, because there's some ageism stuff there that I think people might want to listen to as well, because you're right, like that. And you've written a lot about this, like the idea of demographics being antiquated in the old way. And I really, when you and I jumped on a call, even just a little over a week ago, I thought, you know, I got to have David on the show because values thinking is, it's just like right now, more than ever, I think productivity is more about intention plus attention as opposed to efficiency, effectiveness, all that stuff. I think that you're leading a really great charge, and I'm so glad you're able to bring this to my audience today. Where can people keep up with you and your work so that they can start to look at things and change their behaviors and look at values and start to adopt some of that thinking?
Well, the obvious place, I suppose, is to go to the website, which is valuegraphics.com. And yes, there is an E after value. Some people ask that all the time. I'm all over social media. I'm the least shy guy on the planet when it comes to this. I become an evangelist for values thinking. So it's easy to Google me and find me that way as well. I guess social media wise, I kind of live on LinkedIn. I play around on all the other channels too, but LinkedIn's sort of my home base. So if anybody's interested in having further conversation, for sure, please reach out. I just want as many people as possible to embrace this notion that we can stop using demographic stereotypes, which are nothing but hurtful and harmful, and instead start using values and what we care about as a way to understand each other and indeed change the way we look at the world.
David, thanks again for joining me today on the Productivityist Podcast.
Thanks for having me.